I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a window seat and coach here in 2020. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iscove.
And with us today is David Sims.
He's a staff
writer. There he is.
Sorry, bursting in.
No.
Good, it's good. We're so happy you're here. You also host the Blank Check Podcast, our favorite podcast. But we tell every podcaster they're our favorite. So you really are our favorite, as you know. So thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, guys. It's been a while.
It has. It's and for a significantly better movie than Mystery Men. So that is.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know. Like, I wanted Mystery Men to be the best, and I remember being a little disappointed. But you know, whatever. I don't want to bag on Mystery Men.
Kenny and I are convinced that Mystery Men will be a television series on some streaming platform in less than 5 years.
Yeah, that seems very plausible. Isn't it based? It was based on
a comic,
like little comic, right? So someone owns that. It's just who owns that. Right? Like someone.
But we very 100%. Clearly abandoned the idea of being the writers of said miniseries. So
yeah, it's true. We're not interested in doing it. We're just saying someone's going to do it.
You want it? No. You take it. No. We'll let someone else take this one.
So, David, did you see this film in 99? Did you see The Limey in 99?
Definitely not. Because I would have been 13 when this movie came out. I'm trying to think of the first Soderbergh I would have seen in theaters. I guess it was Aaron Brockovich. It was the next year. But I'm pretty sure this movie, I grew up in Britain.
We're not going to do the bit.
All right. Okay. Thank you. And I'm pretty sure this movie was rated like 18 in Britain, even though it's not. Yeah. It is. It was, yeah. Even though it's not, I mean, it has some gun violence. You know, there's blood, but it's not that bad. So I'm not sure how it earned that rating. But so it would have been impossible for me to see in theater. So I feel like I caught it a couple years later, you know, probably when I was a teenager and I was becoming aware, like, okay, Soderbergh, like, this is a guy to check out. I certainly saw Brockovich, Traffic, Ocean's 11, Solaris, Ocean. You know, I saw all of those in theaters.
Just for our audience, who are a bunch of dumb Americans, I obviously know the answers to these questions. But what do most R-rated movies translate to in Britain? It's a 15 and an 18, is that right?
15 and 18 are the two. And like usually to get Britain, basically, if your movie has like bad language and sex, it's going to be a 15, unless I guess the sex was like truly, you know, very explicit. And so you only really get an 18 if you're violent. Like, you know, it's very violent movies that get an 18 rating. And that means, to be clear, it's not like an R rating in America where you can go if your parent brings you or whatever. Like you have to be over 18 to see an 18 rated movie. So I guess is there like sexual violence would often get like an automatic 18, but I don't know that this technically really, it has some, you know, some violence against women, but like, you know, I don't think of this as like a truly harrowing movie.
It must be the depiction of like a real Cockney Brit that they didn't want a bunch of people to even know that they existed in England, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Maybe it was just like, we cannot promote Cockney violence.
Maybe it was Lem Dobbs being like, too much rhyming slang, and I do not want that foisted upon
Lem is very vocal about his dislike of that on the commentary track, let me tell you. It is amazing. Right.
Why did you guys see this in theaters? Do you remember?
I definitely saw it in theaters in 99. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you did, Kenny.
I know when I saw it the first time. It was in 2000. This is a movie that my friends would sit around and watch late at night because we were, you know, we loved violence. So, so this was a movie I watched in my house. I lived in a house with eight guys, and we watched this quite a bit in 2000, 2001.
So, David, I have a question for you, since, as we know, you grew up in England. Do you know why the limey, that what that means, or how that came to be?
Why Brits are called limeys, or why this Correct. Is called the limey?
Because
of the boats, right? Because of
scurvy.
The boats had citrus, so they could avoid scurvy. That's the thinking, right?
What I love is that it's an American slang for Brits.
Yes, the best Americans could do in terms of like inventing a slur for Brits. It's a little, you know, weak sauce. I mean, I like it. I think now it has become
a slur. Like,
The Brits call Americans like Yanks, right, or things like that. Yeah. You know, like those are the. But like limey just kind of sounds cute, and especially in this movie, it feels very appropriate because it's like all these Americans are like this sort of cartoon Englishman is like, you know, sort of fucking up our stuff. Like, you know, he's kind of like barging around.
Yeah,
and so like he's a proper limey, I guess.
I love it.
It's an old nautical thing though. Yeah. Like I don't know. It's a good term.
Yeah. I do remember looking it up at the time and seeing that it really is not a nice thing to say to or about a Brit. So I thought that was kind of bold in its own way. But I love that idea that this limey comes into LA. No one calls him the limey.
No one calls him a limey. But everyone is kind of baffled by him.
They're all thinking the juxtaposition. You know?
Right. Yeah. Is funny because he is everyone else in this movie is such an LA character, Barry Newman or Peter Fonda or Luis Guzman or like Nicky Cat. These are all like, I feel like they all feel like types out of like an LA noir movie. And it's like he's coming in from a different movie. This is such a good movie, and I don't think it was underrated at the time. I know it didn't do well. Yeah. It's not that surprising that it didn't do well. It's not like a really accessible film.
Yeah.
But it was definitely well received, right?
Yeah.
Very well received.
Yeah, I feel like it's
92% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Right. And yeah, I do feel like it's a little underrated. I think partly because Soderbergh really explodes, his sort of comeback explodes right after. Yep. And people forget to sort of loop this in with that, even though this is definitely a part of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe that's why.
Well, I feel like, you know, obviously your podcast is about filmography, so I just wanted to kind of focus in a little bit on this portion of Soderbergh, because it does feel like this is a real fulcrum point, right? Like, this is a real moment when he's got Out of Sight, which is a critical hit, but not successful, yes, despite the fact that everyone claims that it was. It's not.
It was not. I mean, it wasn't like a disaster. And then he wants to,
as he said in many, right. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, would it make like 30 million? Or, yeah, it was sort of like, all right.
Yeah.
But it also, but I mean, and it wasn't a commercial success, it's true, but it was definitely the best movie of that year. Like there,
There
was. It was 98. There was something about it that felt, because that's a pretty bad year in movies, in my opinion. Yep. So it did feel like this. And 97, I think, is a pretty good year in movies. So it did feel like this shining star, at least in terms of large scale American movies with big stars in it. Right. Whereas the year before, we got, you know, Boogie Nights and The Ice Storm and so many, like, you know, movies like that, like LA Confidential.
Right. Well, to talk about 98, and you guys are 99 boys, obviously, but 98 is interesting because, right, it, like, the Oscar conversation that year is obviously defined by, like, Private Ryan versus Shakespeare in Love. So you've got this, like, big Spielberg, you know, big Oscar-y Spielberg war epic versus a Miramax movie. Like, right. Like, so that kind of defines the year, but I feel like it's the flops of 98 that are all the great ones, like Out of Sight, Last Days of Disco, Big Lebowski, Rushmore, like, you know, Truman, those are the ones where it's like, right, Fear and Loathing, you know, like a lot of movies that at the time people were sort of underwhelming, maybe critically, maybe commercially, but like, you know, grew to be sort of cult movies. And The Thin Red Line is that year. It's a good movie.
Thin Red Line and it was a beautiful, it was Life is Beautiful and Elizabeth were the ones nominated. So the nominees had a real downer vibe to them. Like, if your fun movie is Shakespeare in Love.
I think that's really partly why Shakespeare in Love made it. Yeah, because it was the upbeat movie. And there were these two really intense war movies. And then Life is Beautiful was kind of, you know, it's a comedy, but obviously it's claims to be a Holocaust comedy. Movie. Right.
It's just, it's interesting because, you know, Soderbergh talks about in interviews how he wanted to keep that momentum off of Out of Sight. Like, he didn't want to lose that. He felt like creatively and from a career perspective. So he makes this film very quickly. They literally pitch it, shoot it, and are done like 9 months all in this, which is kind of insane. And he watches the first cut, which is a linear cut, and it doesn't work. And he shits a brick and he's like, oh my God, is this going to stall any sort of momentum that I get out of Out of Sight? So he obviously goes into the editing room and he creates this much more of a kind of much more esoteric kind of,
it's like a memory
tone
play.
Poem. Yeah. Memory.
Right,
play.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's interesting because I wonder, do you get Aaron Brockovich and Traffic and Ocean's 11 without him having a come to Jesus moment with the Limey?
Maybe you're right. So where he's like, because Out of Sight, right, after years of sort of struggling to define himself after the Sex, Lies, and Videotape hype, right, he makes a lot of more indie movies. Yeah. Out of Sight is him being like, come on, guys, look, you know, give me some movie stars, give me a genre film, I will give you something that is way better than it could be, right? Like, you know, something that's really special. Mm-hmm. And then that's what's happening with Aaron Brockovich. Like, Aaron Brockovich is a very packaged, yeah, Oscar movie, you know, it's a true story movie. It's a legal movie. It has a movie, but it's way better than it could be. Obvious. I'm glad, you know, in Ocean's 11, like, you know. So yeah, maybe the Limey, he's like, I'll do a noir movie. I'll do, right? Like, this will be great. Yeah. But there's no way he thought this would be a hit, right? I mean, it stars Terrence Stamp. Like, it's a cheap little movie. Like, but maybe he was just like, with Out of Sight, I had elevated the genre a little bit, and maybe he's looking at this in a straightforward, because it's a very simple movie. The plot is simple. Mm-hmm. So maybe he's looking at it all straightforward, and he's like, oh, no, thank you. It's funny because the other Lem Dobbs movie he makes after this, I know he'd worked with him before.
Yep.
Kafka.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right, but the one he makes after this is Haywire, which is also, that movie is impossible to follow. I've seen it twice. Yeah. I never remember what the plot is. And I don't know what the situation with that script is either, but like, did he cut that one up in a weird way too? Because that movie is a blast. I really like it. It's a lot of fun, but like, I couldn't tell you what the plot is.
They have a fascinating relationship, Lem and him. But yes, go ahead, Kenny.
Soderbergh often seems to follow a big giant hit like a Out of Sight, which I guess it wasn't, but you know, with something that's a complete go fuck yourself. I'm going to do what I want to do. And I consider Haywire that too. I remember when Haywire getting made, him saying almost in a she's all that type dare, I can make a star out of Gina Carano. Like, I can do it.
Right, sure.
You know?
And he almost did it.
He almost did it. Like, there was a moment. Same with Magic Mike. Like, I can make a male stripper movie. You know, I can do it. So he's done this so many times with Bubble and even with Mosaic and all these things where it just, you know, he has this big, massive hit and then says, all right,
Candelabra as well. I mean,
Candelabra?
Yeah. I think that he is someone who likes to, you know, try stuff, is very happy to admit his failures very quickly. Like, it's not like he's someone who, you know, like Logan Lucky, which is a good movie, was him being like, we can market this movie in a different way. I'll cut the trailer myself. We're going to market it to audiences that don't get marketed to as much, like in, you know, the South and in the, you know, like he was trying to find, like, how can we do a cheap out? And it totally didn't work. And when I interviewed him a couple years ago, he was like, yeah, that didn't work. Like, it's not like he's like, well, it would have worked, but like, he was like, no, that didn't work. You know, and same with Unsane, like they make that movie really cheaply. Let's like, you know, and it didn't work. Sometimes it just doesn't take properly. Mm-hmm. And that's, he seems to be kind of chill. I mean, I think maybe when he's making the Limey, he's less chill because he really kind of, you know, he's looking for a foothold again. Now, after he's done the Oceans movie, like, I think he's much more relaxed about like what he has to offer. He's happy.
When,
to
like,
mess
look
around.
At look at Mosaic. I mean, that was an experiment if ever there was one. Like, he's just willing to take swings, you know. And he's also, to your point, willing to admit when he, you know, doesn't connect.
Right. And I think now he's very pro, you know, Netflix and all the, you know, like he's very happy to take advantage of these younger studios that are just, you know, throwing around money to see what sticks on streaming or what, you know, but he likes movies. Like I'm sure he'll make another cinematic film again if like cinemas continue to exist. but right now I think his next movie is an HBO Max movie, right? Yeah. Like I think he just wants to make a movie every 18 months now. That seems to be his thing.
I love that about him. And I love that I love that he is pretty agnostic in terms of where his shit winds up. Like Bubble, very, you know, kind of famously was the first Day and Date film.
Right. That was and a way ahead of its time and like thus a failure, but like a great idea, you know, really obviously becomes a great idea. You know, people are eventually doing that. Right. Yeah. Right.
And even, you know, I remember at the time thinking there was boldness in taking a show like The Nick to Cinemax, which was garbage. I mean, now I'm not even talking about like Cinemax at night. Like I like Cinemax's ethos was we are going to present you with some high-minded garbage. And
right. Cinemax, the other shows were all just like, you know,
shoot 'em ups.
B-movie shit, you know, like Strike Back B-movie or whatever. Like those were like, you know, very, very, right. I never watched a lot of other Cinemax programming.
And I think I respect it so much. I think that we've seen it so many times over the course of, especially TV, because it's so easy to identify a network brand with what's on it. With a show making a network, you know, with, you know, Mad Men coming along and making something legitimate like that. And I really respect I will go to the place that gives me the most freedom to make what I want to do. I think some of these experiments we're talking about as the failed experiments, you almost forget how many of his experiments actually succeeded, right? How many of his great movies are experiments? Sex Lies and Videotape is just an experiment that really succeeded. So I think that's really interesting too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I also love the fact that he's willing to do television as well. I mean, I think The Nick was great. You know, he's apparently working on a 6-part miniseries with Lem Dobbs about Eamon Pasha I don't know who that is, but apparently this person was some sort of I just think it's interesting that he's willing to sort of
some sort of a what, think, Phil? I'm dying to know.
Oh, you can look.
I'll look it up.
But it's I just think it's fascinating that he's limitless, right? He's the type of guy who is looking for ways to challenge himself. You know, in his own way, he's always sort of doing a little bit of what Matthew Barney does, the whole like trying to put restrictions on himself to see how he can succeed.
Right.
And even just like the way he you know, when he won his Oscar, the way, you know, his acceptance speech was all about like, I'm just for art, guys. Like, make art. Go make shit. Like, I don't know what it is.
He's so embarrassed that you remember, do you remember, maybe it was a couple Oscars ago where like apparently the nominees were shown that speech as like, this is the platonic ideal of an Oscar speech. It's short. It's to the point. It says something nice. He's off the stage pretty fast. Like when they were trying to make the Oscars move.
Sure.
And when I remember when I interviewed him, I asked him about that. And he was just like, I was drunk. Like it was the end of the night. And he was very clear in a way that I thought was, I believed him, where he was like, I absolutely did not think I was going to win.
What
like,
a
I was,
teacher's pet.
I was a double nominee. Like, cause he'd been nominated for, and so he was like, I just assumed like I was going to split my own vote. Ridley Scott was nominated that year. You know, that was sort of like the Ridley Scott year. And then there was Ang Lee, you know, like that. It is crazy that he won that year, but
it is.
So I think he just wanted to get off the stage quickly, but you know, he's a smart guy. He gave a very nice speech.
I'll read Eamon Pasha's first paragraph.
Please.
Memon Eamon Pasha, born Isaac Edward Schnitzer, baptized Edward Carl Oscar Theodore Schnitzer, was an Ottoman physician of German Jewish origin, naturalist and governor of the Egyptian province of Equatoria. On the Upper Nile, the Ottoman Empire conferred the title Pasha on him in 1886 there, and thereafter he was referred to as Eamon Pasha. So are you in or out?
I'm in on anything.
Yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So I'm just going to give a brief synopsis of The Limey for the people that might not have seen this film. The Limey follows Wilson, played by Terrence Stamp, a tough English ex-con who travels to Los Angeles to avenge his daughter's death. Upon arrival, Wilson goes to task battling Valentine, played by Peter Fonda, and an army of LA's toughest criminals hoping to find clues and piece together what happened. After surviving a near-death beating, getting thrown from a building, and being chased down a dangerous mountain road, the Englishman decides to dole out some bodily harm of his own. As written by Lem Dobbs, as we talked about, directed by Steven Soderbergh. It was first shown at the 1999 Cannes Film Festival on May 15th and opened in North America on October 8th in 20th place. Artisan was clearly platforming or attempting to platform this movie up against Random Hearts and Superstar, two classic 1999 movies. And it would end up making $3.2 million worldwide on a $10 million budget. It's got 92% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 78% from audiences. It feels like, and I'm curious, obviously, to hear what you guys think of this, but, you know, I went to see this film after seeing Out of Sight and definitely thought I was getting another Out of Sight and left the theater a little bit disappointed. I was 19. I think that I don't think I fully locked into what he was doing. I clearly didn't. I now think the film's a masterpiece. At the time, though, I'm wondering if audiences had similar feelings to me, which is this movie was marketed as he's doing another Out of Sight, but with old guys. But it's much more of an existential kind of, as you said, memory play that I think people just didn't really know how to lock into it. I don't know what you think, David.
I think the first time I saw this movie, I was a little baffled by it. The editing style is so aggressive and unusual that I think as a teenager, I was like, what? I don't. And like, I think my guess is I saw this movie from what I remember, similarly to when I saw Sexy Beast, which is another movie that I very much that's Raymond. Also about like a really intense British Cockney guy, Ben Kingsley in that case, you know, who kind of like dominates the movie. But Sexy Beast, which is great, but that thing looks like a music video. It's really slick. Yeah. It's got all this sort of visual stylization, like to the scene, you know, that's a great movie.
It's also very plotty.
Very plotty. And I think, right, I think I thought this was going to be, oh, yeah, it's like Terrence Stamp giving a wrecking ball performance and just like, you know, smashing through L.A. And in fact, like, I mean, he is giving a wrecking ball performance, but he really, there's only like two scenes that are tense, like that where he is confronting someone, right? Like there's the scene where he enters the party, which is sort of midway through the movie, and then there's the big shootout at the end. The rest of the movie is him like trying to settle on his memories of his daughter and how he feels about the fact that she's gone, or him like chatting with people in this sort of weird and exciting way, like where like they're just having a conversation, but I am like, what's going on? My brain is melting. And especially, I mean, the Bill Duke scene especially, which is kind of like
unbelievable.
Kind of the showiest scene in the movie, kind of the best scene of the movie, probably, right? Yeah. I mean, Bill Duke, he's in High Flying Bird. I'm trying to remember if he's been in another. I feel like Soderbergh knows to drop him. He is such an incredible, I mean, he's a good actor no matter what, and obviously he's a good filmmaker as well, which I think Soderbergh respects him as a filmmaker a lot, but like, he's just, you know, just for a one scene, kind of someone who has total authority, great guy to drop in.
Presence, yeah.
Yeah, it's just fantastic. I mean, I think that part of it, too, is that this movie, as we've said, is the plot and a lot of the character depth has been stripped out of it in the editing room, which is something that Lem Dobbs complains about pretty prolifically in the commentary track, about how he feels like the movie just never got to the place he wanted it to in terms of depth of the surrounding characters. Soderbergh was just like, I just want to tell this story of this father and daughter. Like that's what I want to tell.
Right.
And Lem's feelings are you stripped the guts out of my movie.
Right.
You know, I understand as a writer, I understand taking umbrage with perhaps a director taking a hatchet to your script.
Sure.
But at the same time, I also feel like, I don't know. I don't know if I needed another kind of hard-boiled LA crime story told in a straight line. Like that to me just sort of doesn't seem particularly interesting to me.
I agree. It's like, I've never had the experience of like, I write a movie, I know how it looks in my head, right? You know, that sort of experience, you know. And then you give it to, you know, director takes over. And then when you see the movie, you're like, well, this just isn't what was in my head at all. I'm sure that's a weird disconnect.
Yeah.
I'm sure it happens all the time. Like, it's just, I feel like this movie is just notorious because of that commentary, which of course Soderbergh is kind of a legend for doing, where Lem Dobbs is chewing him out the entire time. That commentary, I feel like became a movie unto itself, like in a culty way, but like, it became a thing that had to be discussed if you were talking the line. Like, did you know that there's this like really sort of confrontational commentary that goes along with the movie?
There are, go ahead, Kenny, sir.
You can do, the thing about that is you could do that about any single movie. Any writer who says they're happy with the way the movie wound up on the screen is lying, or they're really insecure.
Because, sure, right.
You know, because it's impossible for a director to put to take exactly what you want out of a movie. It's also antithetical to what we're doing. That's just not what this art form is for the most part.
It's collaborative. I mean, that's what makes movie making, and that's what makes it exciting.
Another director, when someone else is directing your work, their job is to interpret what's on the page and see it through their lens. Their job is not to try to put. Not to try to be you. If you want that, you can direct your own movies. And I think Soderbergh says to Lem Dobbs,
he does.
At one point,
when are you going to direct?
Which is a great line.
Yeah,
but I don't mind. I mean, I love that it exists because I think it's really interesting from almost a historical document point. And I do think it's the right place for Lem Dobbs to complain about it.
To critique. I would also say too that I love the fact that it's clear, and I don't know if you felt this in your interview with him, David, but Soderbergh likes to be challenged. Like, he wants someone that's going to go toe-to-toe with him. And this commentary obviously is a perfect distillation of that. They're obviously still friends. They're still working together. So, you know, any contention that might exist on this commentary track is, you know, is part of the fun, I would assume, of getting to make this movie. But there's two quotes that I need to say of Lem's from the commentary for people that haven't heard it. He says, "People ask me, do you like this movie? And as a disinterested, objective film goer who had nothing to do with it, I'd say it's a good movie. I'd recommend it to my friends, but as a screenwriter, I think it's crippled." He also says, "Screenwriting is hopeless. If Robert Town still complains about Chinatown, what hope do any of us have?" So I think that this guy is a little bit nihilistic about writing to begin with. So,
right.
I mean, that, that so. I mean.
It's, and the only screenplay credits he has post Limier, the score, which I think he co-wrote with a bunch of people.
Correct.
So I assume he did like a pass on that. Haywire. Obviously, The Company You Keep, that Redford movie that I've never seen, that's sort never of like that, yeah. The Weather Underground-y kind of movie. And then Gaudi, which is a wild credit. I mean, that's a horribly written movie, like, no offense. Like, I don't know that. I don't know. It's not like I saw Gaudi and was like, the problem here is the screenplay, but it's not. Like, I don't remember the writing being good.
Is he the only writer?
So I don't know. Yeah, no, it's with someone else, so I don't know. Who, whatever, like, you know, if Lem, because it's possible, very possible that there had been a Gaudi screenplay floating around for 20 years. Because, like, I mean, the man was a famous monster. Like, it's very, right. So maybe that was, I have no idea. It's just funny that, like, I feel like he's kind of a cool 90s screenwriter. Kafka, Dark City, and The Limey are pretty cool 90s credits. And he's this, like, film historian. He loves noir, you know, like. So it's just I just wonder what happened. That's I mean, what I'm she these are better credits than I've got. Like, I, you know, I just wonder why he hasn't.
No, they're not.
I mean, Haywire is a good movie, but again, the script is not what I love about Haywire.
I do think it's interesting. This commentary track also, I mean, listen, Lem has an axe to grind from credits to credits. Like, there's no question he does. He calls that motherfucker in Variety, like, several times throughout the commentary.
Right. Sure. You know, so
he is. Is that Brian Lowry? No, it's Stevie.
I don't know. yeah, it's Stevie. But yeah, I do think that, I mean, it's hard to say. We're never going to see the cut of The Limey where it's a straight line. And I don't want to see it, quite honestly. But I do think that it's interesting, you know, the big sort of the big cut or the big sort of lift out of the movie that he complains about on the commentary is there's a scene with Anne Margaret, who plays Peter Fonda's ex-wife, who's the woman who owns the house in Big Sur. And he has a scene with her where he basically says, "I got to hide out here, so can you get the fuck out of the house?" And it lifts out of the film pretty easily. Obviously, we didn't need it. I didn't care. You know, I just assumed he had a house in Big Sur. Like, who cares?
Right.
But at one point, Soderbergh says that he'll send him the scene. He's like, "You can fucking have the scene. I'll send it to you." Like, it's just great that they have this sort of back and forth. That's a lot of fun. I don't know.
It is. And it I is. Think you're right. In Soderbergh also, like, rarely writes his own movies, although he has, right? Obviously, he wrote Sex, Lies, and Video. I'm trying to think of, like,
got an Oscar for it. Yeah.
He did. He strikes me as one of those guys who probably he has that kind of like, oh, whatever, you know, attitude a lot of the time. So, like, if he's taking a screenplay credit, it's probably a movie. Like, Solaris is basically his last screenplay credit of a movie he wrote. So it's a movie that he was probably, like, personally driving. Right. But he works with a lot of great screenwriter. What does he talk about? Go ahead.
Sorry, yeah. I mean, he talks in Rolling Stone. He did a pretty long interview right around the 20th anniversary of The Limey last year, near the end of last year, where he talked about how one of the big sort of elephants on his shoulders early in his career was that he wrote everything. And then he realized, like, I'm a competent writer, but I'm not as good as these other people. And he's like, he talks a little bit about Paul Thomas Anderson and how he's like, I respect the hell out of what Paul Thomas Anderson and writer-directors do, but it takes them 4 to 6 years to make a movie because they're taking on this burden of writing it themselves. He wants to make movies faster, and the way to make them faster is to shoot other people's scripts.
Yes. He also just respects stardom in general, I think.
Yeah, he does.
I remember debating that with him a lot. Not debating, just like this interview I had with him was like huge for me, because usually when I'm interviewing a filmmaker, you get 20 to 30 minutes you are going to talk about the movie, obviously, and maybe you have 5 other minutes to sort of play around, you know, and like they're seeing a million people in one, you know, it just can be, it's fine. I've had lots of nice conversations with filmmakers. They just tend to be, but Soderbergh insists on an hour and insists on not like squeezing people in back to back. I think like he only wants to have these long conversations. And
that's
so
cool as that, shit.
That's so
it's
cool.
Very cool. And it was a blast. And but he's also not chummy. Like he's a little scary. Like he's kind of, like, I remember I sat down and he was like, "The Atlantic, what's that like?" And I'm like, he's like trying to throw you a little bit. But I remember we talked a lot about Stardom because like he's worked with so many stars. Terrence Stamp is sort of an unusual one for him, but even here, this movie has such reverence for Terrence Stamp as a star, like bringing in the Ken Loach movie, you know, like, you know sort of
Peter Fonda
and Fonda too. But like, you know what I mean? Like I was saying this to my partner when I was like, people don't remember that. Like Terrence Stamp was like sort of seen as like a pretty boy in the '60s. Like he was this really beautiful looking guy in movies like Billy Budd, like, cause he has this very striking, you know, these sort of, you know, dark eyes and this sort of angular face. And now of course, we think of him as he looks now because he's basically looks the way he looks since the '90s. You know, he's got the sort of the gray hair and like, you know, the sort of Bowfinger look, right? The limey, Star Wars, like the stuff he's in as an older actor.
Yeah.
But he used to be so pretty. Yeah. Anyway, and I just remember talking to, you know.
Man, why is that? Why does Malcolm McDowell go from really, really handsome in like 1980 to 400 years old when he's in The Player? I never understood that.
It's a good question. Yeah, I don't know why. I think McDowell lived like a tough life. Like he strikes me as someone who really partied. I don't like, which I am not sure if that's true, but he does. He has that vibe a little bit. But you know, obviously, Soderbergh worked with Clooney a zillion times. He's worked with all these big stars, and I was like, are there still big stars now? Because I feel like there's a conversation people keep having of like, oh, there's not. You know, Hollywood's generation of stars isn't really as big anymore. Now it's more brands and superheroes. And he was like, no, absolutely. There's still huge stars. Like we were talking about The Report, which he produced, the Scott Burns movie. And he's like, that movie's people talking. And like, if you don't have like Adam Driver, Annette Bening, you know, like it's just boring. Like you need these very magnetic sort of famous people.
You brought up Clooney, and I'm curious because I couldn't really find any of a – there wasn't like a specific reason, but like they were really tight. They had a company together. They had Section 8 for almost like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, maybe even a decade it felt like, where they worked really closely, and then they kind of went their separate ways. And I'm assuming it had to do with, you know, Clooney's desire to direct and perhaps do other things. I don't know what the case is, but it's just interesting that they haven't crossed paths again. And I'm just, you know, I don't know why that is. I don't know if you have any insight into that, but it's just interesting.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is a good movie. It's an important part of his filmography. The other thing, you know, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to say, you know, it does feel like this movie is, it's a turning point for Soderbergh and all of that. But it also feels like a movie that isn't talked about in the 99 conversation very much.
No.
Which I think is interesting.
Because 99 is such a big movie year and it's a small movie.
Yeah, but the reverence that I feel like people have now looking back on it, it's just interesting. And even Soderbergh talks about it in that Rolling Stone interview. He's like, yeah, I read that book, best movie year ever.
Right.
And he's like, it's insane how many movies came out in 99. And he understands why this film didn't rise to perhaps the levels of a lot of the other films, but I think it kind of has. I mean, in film circles, this is a lauded movie.
Yes, I agree with you that in at least more sort of filmy nerdy circles, it probably has written to. It's just with 99, as you guys know, you have to wrestle with like The Matrix, Fight Club, Blair Witch, and I feel like there's a fourth. Like there's, I guess, Phantom Menace, maybe, but like. Malkovich and Magnolia. You have to wrestle with all these movies that are sort of like defining genres, defining indie cinema, and The Sixth Sense. Like, you know, it's like there's that mix of like just huge hits.
Yeah, the high low, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And then Limey, it's like, did that change cinema? No. Like, was it a big hit? Obviously not. But like, is it just sort of like objectively an inarguably great movie? Absolutely. Right. So like that, maybe that's the issue with the Limey, is it's sort of like, it's this perfect little thing. It works so well. But it didn't, you know, its tail is maybe a little shorter, I guess.
One of the things with 99 is all the movies you named, obviously, and some of them are from some of our greatest filmmakers, right? You also have movies like Bringing Out the Dead or...
Sure, yep, right.
I mean, there's one other, Summer of Sam. These movies from incredible filmmakers
Ride with the
that
Devil
are not
is
their best movie.
Ride,
what was that?
Ride with the Devil being another one. Yes.
Great example.
Right.
These movies from these top filmmakers that aren't their best films.
Right.
And I feel like The Limey has kind of fallen into that part of the 99. But to me, yep. I think Bringing Out the Dead's an incredible movie. But like to me, the Limey is top shelf Soderbergh. It's also part of the reason I love 99 so much, which is like you had these like 20 Stone Cold classics at least. But the bench is so deep. The random stuff that is playing in your in your cinema any given weekend is so good and so deep. I mean, since we've come back, we took a little hiatus. Since we've come back, we've hit so many great, incredible movies like But I'm a Cheerleader, which is nothing, you know, in the grand scheme of 99, but in another year, in 2007 or 2008, people would have lost their shit for it. Not because of changing times, just because of a basic lack of product. So I think that's an interesting kind of aspect of this.
Another one that occurred, Existenz, that's another celebrated master making a sort of like movie Peter people are hot cold on. There's one other that occurred to. I was sort of like browsing through. Sleepy Hollow, which I think now is pretty much well regarded, but at the time it was kind of like, I feel like that one had more of a mixed reputation at the time.
It's not considered Tom Burton. So
right. Which there you go.
I think it's also interesting to talk to in terms of like Terrence Stamp's performance in this. The movie wasn't a hit, so I get it. But this easily could have been a Best Actor nomination. I'm a little surprised that, you know, your old school Academy in 99 didn't give Peter Fonda one or perhaps give Terrence one. I looked, you know, looking at the five nominees, it's a solid Best Actor category, but
Fonda
like.
Fonda makes sense, but.
Well, I think. The movie didn't do well enough, right? Like, if it had done better, maybe it would have gotten a little more buzz. Right. But you also have the Richard Farnsworth nomination as the kind of, all band together and get this sort of beloved veteran a nomination. Like, that's that slot. I mean, because Spacey, Crow, Washington are pretty much, those are sort of obvious. Like, Kevin Spacey, American Beauty, Russell Crowe, big transformational performance in The Insider. Denzel Washington, you know, big star playing a real person in The Hurricane. So, like, I guess Sean Penn is a little surprising, but that's also kind of a weird transformative performance. And obviously the Oscars were really into Sean Penn in the 90s. Yeah. Like, he got a lot of nominations.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who missed out. Like, I'm trying to think of, like, who else was sort of close there? Because, like, Terrence Stamp's not even getting, like, a Golden Globe nomination, right?
I mean,
like,
close is an interesting term because it does kind of feel at the time like most of those guys are pretty set. But looking back now, I mean, you have like, to me, we all think that Matt Damon should have been nominated, you know, for Talented
Mr. Ripley. That's certainly, that's a big one. Yeah.
And Nicolas Cage is to me like incredible in Bringing Out the Dead. Tom Cruise and Eyes Wide Shut should have won. So like there are so many of these things that in retrospect, I think are obvious. Well, like Damon and Cruise to me and Nicolas Cage. And, those are incredible. Every year we do our re-Oscars for the movies we've seen. So, and I would even say Pacino in The Insider, but...
Seeing who the big snub was this year, the one that I remember being the snub, which is Jim Carrey in Man on the Moon, who won the Globe. And people, I think, after Truman Show, he won the Globe for both Truman Show and Man on the Moon.
Yeah.
And I think after Truman Show, you know, he missed out on that. I think people were like, oh, well, he'll get this. He's playing a real person, yada, yada. And again, he missed out, and it became this sort of narrative of like, oh, clearly this he is regarded as a pain in the ass, right? Because it must, like, there's a weird sort of bias against Jim Carrey at this point.
Yeah.
So they gave it to another pain in the ass in Sean Penn.
That's true.
And they gave the award to the biggest pain in the ass.
I mean, that's the thing. Sean Penn, the other thing is that it's just Woody Allen movies were beloved by the Oscars, like, even if they were small. Like, you know, he just had that traction that I guess Soderbergh doesn't quite yet. Like, Soderbergh had gotten that Sex, Lies, and Videotape nomination, but apart from that, you know, it's next year that they're finally like, hey, you know what? You know, hey, you're great. Like, you're in the
team. That's it for him with the Oscars, right? For the most part, in the Traffic, Aaron Brockovich.
You mean after Traffic, Aaron Brockovich? Yeah.
Traffic, Aaron Brockovich, double nomination and all that. I don't know if he was nominated for anything again after that.
I don't think so. He doesn't make a lot of Oscar-y movies. Yeah,
I was just gonna say he never. I don't know that he takes another like legit Oscar swing. You know what I mean? Like you mentioned how Aaron Brockovich is like.
I think Solaris was two things at one time. I think Solaris was absolutely a passion project that was unlike anything else, and it's one of my favorite movies.
I love it.
I also think in the world where, you know, every time Terrence Malick made a movie, it was getting nominated, I think he thinks it could have – I'm sure he thought that there was a world where that movie could have gotten nominated.
Perhaps. I mean, my point more than anything is I was rewatching a little bit of Aaron Brockovich last night, which I think is like works like fucking gangbusters. That movie is just – it just knows what it's doing. It's fantastic. And from the second that Julia Roberts shows up on screen, you're like, she's winning an Oscar. Like there was never a question. It might be the biggest Oscar lock that, within my generation that I can think of, where you're just like, yeah, she's winning.
Right.
So. Can we play that game real fast? Yeah. What else is on that list? The biggest Oscar lock from the moment you saw them. I mean, I have mine. There's the most obvious one to me. What? Is Jamie Foxx and Ray. Like, you just knew the moment you heard him.
Yeah. I know what you mean about that. Yeah, that did feel like... I mean, it's the big transformational performance because you know how well those go over. I'm trying to think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big Philip Seymour Hoffman and Capote fan, but I think there were some people that felt like that was another one.
I mean, he shooed right in. I mean, that's the thing. Like, also, Last King of Scotland. Like, anytime you would see those performances where you're like, oh, this just feels right. I mean, that's how I felt. I remember when I saw Marriage Story at Toronto, and the audience, like, burst into applause after Laura Dern's big speech. And I was like, oh, right, this is obviously just going to happen. Because it's the combo of, like, people like the performance, and it's just everyone's ready to give her an Oscar. Because that's the thing with Roberts, too, is, like, she had mounted enough of a comeback. She had sort of burnished her star image. Now it's like, yep, like, congratulations. We're ready to give you an Oscar.
It's cute.
Monique and Precious was one of those.
Oh, Monique and Precious, 100%.
And that's the opposite, where, like, she didn't even really campaign. She was kind of a little hostile to the Oscars. And it was just because it was like, who gives a shit? She's winning. Like, there's no question. Like, that's just a performance. Everyone's like, it's sort of undeniable this year.
Yeah.
I fully agree with that. I mean, I really
Hudson, too, to some extent.
Yeah. I think that Terrence Stamp in this movie, just to highlight his performance for a second, the way he delivers lines is so intense, like through gritted teeth, basically. I mean, at least the opening line of "Tell me about Jenny," but it's. It's so close. Like, this could have tipped so easily into caricature, but he keeps the whole thing grounded. He makes it feel lived in. Part of it has to do with Poor Cow to a certain degree, which is the Ken Loach film that Soderbergh gets the rights to from Warner Brothers to be able to intercut into this. So it just gives that history to this character that just makes him feel much more lived in. But my God, like, just... You know, we were talking about that scene in the DA agent's office where he's just going off on a Cockney rant of just, you know, of the greatest proportions, and it's played for jokes. But the rest of the movie, he's foreboding. Like, he is a legitimately scary person.
I think that scene is crucial, the Bill Duke scene, because initially he's just this sort of frightening guy, and he's playing up the cartoonishness, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Intentionally, right? Like, he's like, I'm going to, like, you know, freak people out. Like, right? Like, I'm going to, you know. And then in the Bill Duke scene, he is initially doing his whole thing. And you're cutting, you know, like, he's, Soderbergh is doing that crazy, where, you know, where the quick cuts as he's talking. Mm-hmm. And then we're cutting back to Bill Duke, who is still, like, very, you know, unmoved and very, like, unentertained. And then you see him finally chilling out. Like you see Stamp kind of, like, settling down and getting more reminiscent. So, like, and in those scenes, you're like, oh, God, he totally has a handle on this character. Like, it's not just him being like, all right, I'll do some sort of Cockney rhyming slang and I'll be intense.
Yeah, it's really it's a really masterful performance. I mean, I think that the way that, you know, and Kenny mentioned it in our opening, but the movie continually cuts back to Terrence sitting in that airplane, and us not knowing if that's him going to LA or leaving LA. The reveal, obviously, at the end being that he's leaving, and what reads on his face with the slightest of emotion throughout the film is a testament not just to the editing of the fact that, like, his face speaks differently at different points in the film, but just this, it's just the subtlety of, and the nuance of Terrence's performance is just is really remarkable.
I mean, sorry, David. Yeah, no, it's fine. I was just going to say, like, think about describing this movie to someone. It's a British guy. His daughter died. He's trying to get revenge. Like, and there's just not, and, like, it would be, it's hard to sell this movie to someone just based on plot. I guess you would sell it as, like, it's this big performance. It's this, like, must-see performance. But,
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. I would sell it to most people by saying it's a revenge thriller. And then I think you get so many scary bros on board. Yeah. We did Payback already. Which is Payback is point blank, right?
And Payback is point blank. I haven't seen it in years. How did that hold up? I saw that when I was like a teenager.
We did the director's cut, right, Phil? It was baddish.
Yeah,
but baddish, right? Yeah. So it's like it's not a terrible movie, you know.
The Mel Gibson of it all kind of swallows that movie on some level. So it's kind of hard to see it through a. But I know what you're saying, Kenny. It was not great.
It wasn't great, but like. Revenge thriller, you've done so much of the work already. You have a very clear motivation and you have a, you know, there's so much pathos built into a character who's lost and is trying to revenge that you can just go on that journey. What always kind of bothered me about Point Blank, and this is kind of stupid, but is how easily, I forgot the guy's name. What's the main guy in Point Blank?
You mean Lee Marvin?
Lee Marvin. How easily Lee Marvin tackles every situation. He's outmanned by four guys. He punches two of them in the balls, and everyone goes down. And he's never challenged in the situation. What I loved about this was how realistic I felt like every confrontation Terrence Stamp was in felt. He did not feel like the guy who was going to go in and beat the shit out of four guys and move on to the next room. In fact, when he was presented with four guys, they beat the shit out of him, and it was only because he's a crazy motherfucker that he went back in there and shot four of them, or three of them, I guess.
Yeah, I agree.
And I love that about this movie. I love how believable I felt like the whole thing was in its own way. A man with truly nothing to lose, and who's willing to kind of do whatever it takes. And then the ending when he pulls back right at the last moment is incredible to me.
Yeah, I also just want to talk for a second about Luis Guzman in this film, who is
so good.
So good. And listen, I don't know what was cut, what didn't make the cut, and what have you. But the performance that we got, which is perhaps one of the most stripped down Luis Guzman performances, not really playing for jokes, as he usually does. It's a really solemn, emoting, thoughtful performance from Luis Guzman. And it's a bummer that we don't see him do that more. I mean, he's kind of that in Traffic, but not really. I mean, he's kind of played more for jokes in that.
He usually is your, I mean, and I guess that's his role here too. It's maybe this is just kind of like a weirdly muted movie in a way, but like he's, yeah, right, he's your guy you bring in. He's an incredibly charismatic reader or of any dialogue. Like he just is yeah, naturally just very funny and very magnetic. And this is just the absolute, when he is the king of character actors, it's like him and, you know, honestly, like Philip Seymour Hoffman and John C. Reilly, those guys who get used a lot by the Paul Thomas Andersons, mm-hmm, and Steven Soderbergh, you know, like, so with what he's like Boogie Nights, Out of Sight, Snake Eyes, The Limey, Magnolia, Traffic, like where he's just like always yeah, popping up, always funny. Mm-hmm. But you're right. This is a more,
love it.
Yeah. It's, and it's sort of low key, and maybe that's because Stamp is actually so, mm-hmm, you know, cartoonish in a way. Like that he's kind of reacting to that, and he's like, you know what, I'm going to play this guy as kind of like exhausted almost.
He also plays something in this film, and I don't think it's romantic, but he loves Jenny. Like you can really right, sense how
that's
heartbroken
why he's in
he is.
This. Right, right. Yeah, and it's why Stamp, it's why Terrence Stamp trusts him. Like, mm-hmm, you know, you might just begin the movie with him like throwing him around the room, but like you can tell that Wilson's just like, no, yeah, I can tell that, you know, whatever, you're genuinely upset about this.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, that's part of the power of the editing of this film too, is that one of the things that Soderbergh retains is how much everyone loved Jenny. Like Leslie Ann, yeah, Warren loved her, and Peter Fonda loved her. Like she doesn't, we don't hear a line of dialogue, I think, from Melissa George in this entire film.
We don't.
And
only in muted, right? Like, yeah.
It's tremendous. It also, you know, part of the lyrical component of this film, which is obviously really beautiful, is that at the end of the film, we have the moment when I guess Wilson sort of inadvertently realized that he was part of the reason she died, that this phone gig that they would do, bit that they would do with her threatening to call the cops, is what led to the fight with Peter Fonda, which led to her death. Now, I don't know if that necessarily is the reason that he doesn't kill him. I think he doesn't kill him because he's grown and he has learned the error of his ways to a certain degree or another. But I don't know what you guys interpreted it as.
That's how I interpret it. It's sort of that. Well, it's also that, like, see, you know, being reminded of how she was as a kid and how she was as a grown up, you know, being like, he's reminded that, like, oh, right, she would not want me to do this. Like, and like, you know, she was always trying to keep me on the straight and narrow as best she could. And so there's that, like, he's sort of getting pulled out of vengeance mode by that kind of memory, I guess.
There's also, like, a bit of a magic trick with the Peter Fonda performance, the way he's written, the way he's shot, the way he's portrayed. The fact that this guy is basically, you know, one of the first things you learn is that he knew his current girlfriend's parents because he suggested her name. So he's known this person since she was a baby.
Yeah.
So and right off the bat, you're skeptical. But when he gives that, Phil, you send it to me. When he gives that little monologue about the 60s, and I
can read it if you want me to read it real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
Did you ever dream about a place you never really recall being to before, a place that maybe only exists in your imagination, some place far away, half remembered when you wake up? When you were there, though, you knew the language, you knew the way around. That was the 60s. It wasn't actually that either. It was 66 and early 67. That's all it was.
So there's something about that and the way this movie shot that taps into something that I feel about LA that I have completely lost in the 15 years I've been here. But the way I felt about LA before I moved here was like that monologue, right? I was never so attached to the Hollywood parts of it. It was always the, for lack of a better comp, the Fletches of the world, the things that existed around Hollywood, the down to Beverly Hills, though, you know what I mean? And I think the Limey taps into that to some extent for me. And Peter Fonda is the POV to give you that. I don't want him to die at the end of this movie is what I'm getting at. I don't think that he is a murderer. I think that he is a sad, lost soul. And I think it would almost be cruel to kill this guy at the end of the movie. That's how I felt.
Yeah, it's sort of a bit of a red herring. It's like a good red herring in that, like, when he's introduced, you're like, oh, I get it. This guy's a scumbag. Like, this right. is the villain. Great. I'm zeroing in on this. And Fonda was playing a lot of villains. And, like, remember he was in Ghost Rider. Like,
oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
He had sort of made this, like, late career. Like, he's kind of devilish, I guess, in a way. Like, the sort of sunglasses, like, his whole look.
Well, he became a paycheck guy, right? It definitely
had some... Yeah, needed money or something. I don't know.
I think there's also, I mean, that this all taps into the fact that this film is about being over the hill. It's about the end of your life. It's about looking backwards. And it's about how Peter Fonda looks backwards fondly. And it's about how Terrence looks back not fondly. Like for him, it's all the past is filled with mistakes and things that he regrets. Peter Fonda looks back on it and says, like, I had a great time. I lived a great life. I mean, I think I think also part of that he's not a villain thing taps into the fact that all this sort of mishigas, for lack of a better way of putting it, is because he was running out of money. So he got into bed with these guys to kind of find a way to keep the lifestyle that he had grown accustomed to because he felt as though it was slipping away from him. So all of this makes him very wounded and sad and broken in a way that you don't want him to die at the end.
Yeah, he's like a character from like a Warren Zevon song. He is very LA in that way. And he has like the house that was probably super cool at one point and now has this kind of like retro look that, you know, is cool in its own way, but is sort of like that like slightly faded LA. I mean, I wonder if Fonda cared that he was being used this way or not. I don't know. Like, you know, because he's definitely, Soderbergh is definitely trading on Fonda as, you know, a star of yesteryear.
David, have you ever seen the documentary? Sure. I guess they call it a film essay. The LA plays itself or Los Angeles plays itself.
Yes.
So you know how they has a very long section on those modern houses and how they're always. And he, the writer of the writer director of this movie is very fond of those houses, and he hates the way they're always used to symbolize the villain. I love those houses too, right?
It's true. They are, but like, I think LA Confidential, there's so many movies where it's like a villainous den.
Lethal
Weapon.
And those houses are amazing to me and they're gorgeous and you only find them in LA or they only really belong in LA. I think that is your little shorthand right there for this guy is a soulless piece of shit. Which is ironic because he, you know, obviously made his money feeding people's souls. So, which I love. But yes, I think that house is amazing and gorgeous. And I love the idea that I didn't really realize because I always considered those houses to be modern. Those houses were all built in the 50s.
Right.
You know, those are old houses. That's an old idea of the future. And that's something I find really kind of charming about them.
Well, it's funny you bring up the house because Wilson and Eduardo have a tremendous scene by the pool that's filled with just incredible dialogue where basically Wilson is looking out at the view and he says, it's like, goes like, wow. And Eduardo says, yeah, if you can afford a house like this, you buy a house like this. And then Wilson's like, he's standing on the pool, right? And he turns to Eduardo and says, what are we standing on? And Eduardo says, trust, which is just incredible. Cause like the house is amazing.
There's also Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I feel like, uses that, where it's like the house that Leo's character has in that, which is, you know, a smaller version, but like that you know, it's got a pool. Like, he's like, that was when I made it, when I could like buy that house. Like, that was, and I'm never going to let go of it. Like, you know, that's sort of like the symbol of his stardom or what his brief stardom to himself. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead, Kenny.
If you doubted that Luis Guzman was an actor or trying to be an actor in that movie, that line gives it away.
100%. He also has what I would maybe argue is one of the best lines in the film, where he says, you could see the sea out there if you could see it.
Yeah, that's a great line.
Right.
That is the most typical fucking LA real estate thing, period. I've been in so many houses where people have said, you know, you can see the ocean out there on a clear day.
So, It's really something. It's really something impressive. On the commentary, you also get to hear Soderbergh talk about Fonda and how he really kind of let him off the chain and just really kind of let him do whatever he wanted to do. And there's the scene after Wilson throws the bodyguard over the railing, and obviously the ambulance comes and picks him up. The cops show up. Avery is talking to Valentine, and Peter's really loose in that scene. You can sense that there's very little guardrails on like the lines and the way that he's saying them, which is really, really special. And then at the end of the scene, Avery says, you know, something about like, you always seem to dodge a bullet. And apparently Peter Fonda made up the line, "I learned how to skate when I was young," as he's walking out of the room. And then as soon as he yells cut, he tells Soderbergh a story about how some famous fucking actor taught him how to ice skate or some shit.
Sonja Henie, who was like Olympic gold medalist from Norway, the world's most famous figure skater until like the 90s. Yep. Until like the 80s. So like Katarina Witt.
Yeah.
Because he was, you know, he's Harry Fonda's son.
I want to talk real quick about Nicky Catt, David, because I feel like Nicky Catt had a moment. And then he disappeared.
I know. I mean, I think now he's best known for that, like, for being part of the Dark Knight's most famous sequence. He's in the van. Like, right, that became his weird swan song, which is odd because he's not old. Like, he's 50, I think. And I don't know why he stopped making movies. I don't know if there's a story to that. Like, you know, if he either. Just, because, like, in the 90s, he would pop up and stuff, and he was kind of a good villain, kind of like in movies like Insomnia, right? Like he's sort of like a supporting character who's kind of prodding at things. Mm-hmm. Like he's a little, you know, like he would pop up and stuff like that, and you'd be like, "Yeah, Nicky Catt, I know him."
He's got Adam Gold.
Soderbergh uses him. Yeah, 100%, right. And, like, Soderbergh uses him in this in Full Frontal. Is he in another Soderbergh movie? I feel like Soderbergh liked him.
Yeah, you know, the last movie he was in was Behind the Candelabra, interestingly enough.
Right, which he's, yeah, he, right, he's got a little, go. Yeah. I you know, I like Nicky Catt. Boiler Room is sort of like when he's almost a star, not a star, but, like, he's almost a leading man, right? Yeah. Usually he was your supporting guy, but, like, I'm genuinely interested to know, because I think he was a child actor. Like, I think he had worked in the biz since he was a kid. So I'm genuinely interested to know if he just decided, like, you know what? I had a good run. I'm going to tap out. Like, I'm, you know, goodbye. Just, I was a guy who's like, yeah.
He's so acerbic and droll. Like, he's no one delivers a line quite like him. And I think that he's just that guy that you want to have in your company, that you want on your bench, which is why, you know, he obviously tended to work with filmmakers that had sort of big ensembles for the most part. I mean, like, he's in Suburbia. He's really good in Suburbia as well, the Linklater film. Like, he was really good. I mean, maybe there's a story there. I don't know. But this, to me, felt like, when he showed up, I was like, oh, fuck yeah, I forgot he was in this. And then he steals every scene he's in.
He does.
Yeah.
He's really he does. Yeah. He's really fun in this. I mean, this movie, anytime, like, he becomes, he's sort of a weird red herring in this movie, right? Like,
yeah. Yes.
When they drop him in, you're like, oh, this is going to be, you know, this will be part of the whole. And, like, you know, he becomes kind of more just like a bit of a cute distraction, but he's another LA type. Yes, right? The kind of like for hire scumbag is an LA type, and he is very good at that. Leslie Ann Warren stuff is also good.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Yeah. She's really good. Sorry, Kenny, I didn't hear what you said.
I know, white guy with dreads. That's a real 90s. You know, that's that Gary Oldman thing that that you would never dare do today. But
oh my God. Yeah. Or Angelina Jolie in Gone in 60 Seconds.
I mean, they did it with Charlize like 2 years ago in Fast and the Furious, but it's a little different.
They did. This is the second time we get a magic carpet ride needle drop in 99. The first one being in Go. that high mounted shot on top of Valentine's convertible down the PCH is one of the best shots in the movie. It's just that locked off shot. It's just beautiful. It reminded me of the shot, a similar shot in Phantom Thread that Paul Thomas Anderson has when they're at night driving behind the car. It's that whole PCH sequence, the whole story that Fonda tells about the motorbike and Easy Rider, which apparently Soderbergh just told him to tell that story. So he just told that story. It's,
I mean, he strikes me as a guy with a lot of stories too. Like, cause he's the guy who like, he's the guy who gave the Beatles acid, right? Like, you know, like he's the one who says, I know what it's like to be dead. Right. Isn't that the urban legend? Like that was a line that he said to Paul McCartney at a party or whatever. Like, he's been around. And of course, then also he's Hollywood royalty. Like, his dad is one of the great golden age actors. Like, so I'm sure Peter Fonda is overflowing with like the kind of showbiz stories that Steven Soderbergh would just like, yes, as much as possible. Give it to me.
But apparently I had a real cast him. Right. You read that, right? That
really?
Soderbergh had to be convinced by Dobbs to cast Peter Fonda. I don't know who he had in mind.
That's nuts, though, because Fonda's so well cast.
I mean, it does strike me in some ways as a role that a lot of interesting actors could have done interesting things with it, but it would never have been the same.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of takes on that role that you can offer up, I guess.
The fight at the end. The gunfight at the end. Mm-hmm. I kind of love how not great Soderbergh is at shooting action.
And also just no one in the movie is particularly good at shooting people. Like, everyone's just kind of like, it's probably how it would go, right? Like, it was kind of clipping each other, kind of firing
they're hitting
wildly.
Shoulders,
the security
they're
guards.
There's also something great about at the end, they're on the beach, which is that beautiful magic hour blue lighting. And Wilson is walking towards Valentine, who's broken his ankle, and he's just shooting. And Wilson's not even like moving. He knows that none of these bullets are going to come close to him. It's amazing. It's such a great
shot. That walk is very iconic, right? Where he's just like very deliberately walking across the rocks. He seems to have no fear that Fonda's going to clip him at all. And again, there's another movie where it's like he's a Terminator. He reaches his kill and he executes. And then instead, of course, you have this nice, you know, quote unquote, nice moment of him sort of putting all these flashbacks, these that have been like unfolding throughout the movie together. You know, you have the kind of Bleach bypassy flashbacks of Melissa George, you know, grown up. What's your Jennifer? And the poor cow stuff and the flashbacks with her as a kid and all that stuff. I don't know what Lem Dobbs' problem is, except that he wrote a different movie, I guess. I guess that's his problem. But like, if I saw this, I think I would just be like, holy shit, oh my god, this is great. I had no idea this was in there.
I know.
Yeah.
It's like the Stephen King Shining stuff. I'll never understand what Stephen King's fucking problem is. Because even if you think that you wrote something different and that there's a better version with Steven Weber on ABC, that you ultimately you have to respect that this is that what Kubrick did with your piece of your piece of literature is so important for the world. Like, you did it. Go ahead, David.
It's the Stephen King thing, as far as I can tell. For one, he seems like a prickly guy, and also he's sold a bajillion books, so he probably just thinks he knows best. But like, I think The Shining for him is Stephen King's like confession. It's like him being like, "I'm a shitty husband, I'm a shitty dad, I'm drunk." Like, you know, right when he's and then he sees this movie, and he's like, "It wasn't about how I'm a psycho. It wasn't about, you know, like he's just completely baffled by Nicholson. He's baffled by all the change, you know, and you know." Whereas it's obvious Kubrick read the book, and he was like, this is trashy, but I like the hotel idea. I like the, you know, the cabin fever thing. And they're both right. Like, you know, or whatever, you know, like King's book is good in its way. The movie is good in its way. They don't align very well, but that's okay. It's okay to have, you know, different things.
It's all there.
The thing that's crazy is that Dr. Sleep. About. The thing I like about Dr. Sleep is that it somehow is a sequel to both. Like, I, you know, which is why it's not totally successful, but the Dr. Sleep, he's like, I'm going to do a sequel to the film The Shining, but I will also adapt this book that is so much about how The Shining was poorly made as a movie, right? You know, like the book is very much like all that shit in the movie no, like, you know, the sequel is not going to tell it at all, right? You know, he somehow does both.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. David, we were going to do our top five Steven Soderbergh films. So hopefully you're on board to do that as well.
For sure.
I'll start at number five. My number five is Aaron Brockovich. I mean, we talked about it a little bit already, but I will say this. I don't know that anyone makes a studio movie that doesn't feel like a studio movie better than Soderbergh does. Like, that film is top to bottom. I mean, literally two studios made Aaron Brockovich. It stars arguably one of the biggest movie stars in the world. But it's bleached out as fuck. It's shot in such a lo-fi way. He just gets it. He gets how to make a movie that isn't showy. And then on the flip side of it, he can make Ocean's 11 and make you the greatest fucking, you know, big studio movie ever. So that's my
Aaron Eckhart in that movie too. I love him.
So good.
He's great. He's great. It's against type for Eckhart, and also for the type he's playing. Like, when he rolls in, you're like, oh, I get what this character is. He's a sweetie pie.
Yeah.
That's great. I love that movie. That was an early grown up movie for me, as I was saying. You know, I saw that in theaters, and it's like, if I was seeing R-rated movies at that time, it was probably more because they were like action movies or whatever. Like, that was just like, oh, this is just like a movie about grown-ups dealing with shit and swearing and, you know, like living lives. And like, I remember it blowing my mind when I was a kid. And every time I revisit it, I just think it's so tonal. It's not in my top five. It's right outside. It's probably number six for me. But like, it's like you say, it's very like the film grain, like the way it sort of captures that kind of like blasted, deserty California, like sort of strip mall-y like world. The sort of the Sheryl Crow on the soundtrack, like it's such a perfect timepiece. And obviously Finney is just extraordinary in that. That is Soderbergh. I mean, Julia Roberts is great too, but like,
oh, so good.
Finney, that's Soderbergh being like, you can ham this up a little bit because you're a movie star and I need you to give me what you got. Like, you don't need to approach, you know, because he knows that Finney is kind of a hammy actor in a great way.
Yeah.
Love that movie.
Yep. What's your number five, David?
It is Ocean's 11, which it could arguably be his number one movie. I just like a lot of Steven Soderbergh movies. And my three to five is very close together. I know what my one and two are very easily, but I have Oceans at five. You know, come on. It's just the problem. The only flaw with Ocean's 11 is that it's so slick that when you watch it, you're like, oh, well, that's like a popcorn movie. That's confection. Like,
yeah,
he did that in his sleep. Like, he got these movie stars. He shot Vegas, nothing even bad seems to happen. Like, it seems to just go so well. Like, you know, like you don't understand how impossible it is to make a movie like that until you see lots of examples of it being done badly. Right.
Or just, I don't know, look at the original, which is boring as fuck.
Well, sure. Which is so boring. I remember reading an interview with them at the time. Like, it was like Empire Magazine interviewed like Soderbergh, Clooney, Pitt, Damon, right. You know, and they were like, you know, when we got together to make it, like, the first thing we did was we screened Ocean's 11, and, you know, it fires up, and you got the music, and you're like, oh, my God, Vegas in the 60s, guys, and then, like, 5 minutes in, they were like, oh, Jesus, turn this off.
Let's talk about, I know that I'm positive Phil has it higher, and so do I.
Yeah, as do I.
But,
but
we can talk about it a little more now. Ocean's 11 was one of my dad's favorite movies, the original. So I watched it as a kid a lot.
Oh, boy.
And you know, there's a little nostalgia to that for me, but it is a terribly boring movie. I think Ocean's 11, I think I've said it before on this podcast, I think it is the best studio movie ever made. At least in the last 30 years, in terms of something that was crafted to be a blockbuster and actually was a blockbuster. It's not my number one, but Ocean's 11 is the most watchable movie of all time.
Like, it's so like, rewatchable.
It's period. End of sentence. It is the most watchable movie. My 8-year-olds flipped out for it. I will not turn it off. I don't feel that way about any movie now in like the era of on demand, where if it comes on, I'll stick with it. It is, to your point, David, it is not worth even deconstructing this movie because you will never do it. Right. Whenever you bring it up in a writer's room or in a pitch or whatever, you inevitably find how difficult it is to do one scene of this movie, let alone the whole mechanism. So you can see
how wonderful it is by comparing it to the other two films in its trilogy as well. I mean, I think Ocean's 12 is a failure, but like a noble failure. I appreciate the swing. Ocean's it certainly 12. Would fill your blank check podcast for sure in terms of like that's a blank check movie that some people would be on board with and some people might not be on board with. And then 13 is just a shrug.
Disagree on both Ocean's 12 and Ocean's 13. Both incredible. I advise to rewatch them. They rule. Okay. I mean, Ocean's 12 is a movie about Hollywood and about making sequels and how important, right? Like, it's a very meta movie. And then I think, like, for 13, he's like, oh, you guys wanted, like, Vegas? Like, you just wanted, like, another fun Vegas movie? Great. I'll just give you a movie that's about how Vegas is the coolest, even though it's the cheesiest. Like, that is...
I have to admit, I have not seen 13 since the theater, so...
I think it is incredibly underrated. And I, too, had kind of forgotten about it, like, after I saw it in theaters. Right. And I recently, in the last year or so, I watched all three again. Mm-hmm. And I was like, shit, 13 is good. I forgot that 13's really good. And the ending is incredible. Like, the ending is kind of like gives you shivers. And it's kind of about, like, you know, it's got that whole thing where it's like if you shook Sinatra's hand, you're in a club. And like when you hear that, like, you're like, God, that is such horseshit. And then, you know, but then you're like, oh, but of course, like, that's who these characters are. Like, of course they would feel that way. You know, like, and it's sort of like,
yeah,
it's got them, like, whereas 12 is like, this is all in, you know, this is all dessert. This is all silliness. 13 is a little more like, no, come on, these guys give a shit about this. We can give a shit about it.
I'd like to watch 13 again. 12 I have watched again very recently. And
12
is
just insane.
And I think 12 is an abomination. I for a very specific reason. And this is maybe coming from a personal place, but I've written on a few shows that have gone multiple seasons, as have you, Phil. And at some point, you have to accept that you are no longer going to get a new audience, that you are no longer going to win an Emmy, the critics are not going to care about you, that Twitter's not going to talk about you, and your only job at that point is fan service. You have to protect the audience you have and also give them what you want, and they deserve it. For sticking through with your show. For Soderbergh to come after Ocean's 11 and make a esoteric French new wave adjacent film about jerking each other off, essentially, that isn't for anybody who loved Ocean's 11 is such a insult to people who love that movie. I think it is so condescending and patronizing. So to your point, Ocean's 13 point, to do that, to do it 13 under duress kind of bothers me too, but at least I will give it another chance.
I have always wondered about 13 if they were like asked to make it or pressed to make it. Like if they themselves were like, no, we should do another one. Like, cause it right. 12 did okay. It did fine, but it didn't do as well as 11. And it was, you know, you could have sort of been like, oh, you know what? We didn't need to make sequels to Ocean's 11, but like 13 kind of makes the whole thing, the whole package work a little better. Well,
I think that, anyway. I mean, Clooney and Soderbergh kind of needed a hit around then a little bit too, where I think they both wanted just a little bit of, you know, a little bit more, you know, clout behind them. But so what's your number five, Kenny?
My number five is America's most popular movie, Contagion.
Contagion rules. God, what a good movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie. It also has some of that, like, you know what's going on in 3 seconds. And you're right in the middle of it. It's so fucking scary. And it's obviously, you know, we're living through it. So it's pretty amazing. But
but it has that sort of competence porn angle as well, where it's like, it's kind of great to see people who like are good at their jobs and know what they're doing. I mean, it's also got that thing. And Contagion and Ocean's 12 are right outside my five. So that's one reason I'm sort of like in on them. I was talking to Alex Ross Perry recently, who's been on my show a bunch, about it, I guess because we were talking about the phenomenon of people watching it. And he's like, that movie, it's like black screen, cough, cough, day mm-hmm. two. Like, you know, where he's just like, it gets into the rhythm of all of that so quickly. Like, he's so good at knowing the skeleton of those kinds of, like, these kinds of genres yeah. and knowing when to pull out and when to just sort of, like, barrel through.
This is, I think this speaks to why Ocean's 12 bothers me so much. Because most of his movies...
It's him being like, these things are silly, you know.
Well, he has such faith in the audience. He in general, he thinks his audience is at least somewhat film literate, that they don't need the bullshit explained to them. And Ocean's 12 feels like... It feels like he's basically saying, can you go with me here? Can you do this with me? Like, I don't know. It bothers
it's a
me.
Test. It is a test to the audience for sure. I agree with that.
But I think I do love Contagion. Yeah. I think Contagion was also just an incredible movie-going experience. It does this thing that Outbreak did too. I love Outbreak. Where you're sitting in the theater and looking around at everybody in there with you and being like, holy shit, I'm pretty close to you. You know, like,
Holy shit, you
could kill me with a cough. So it's good.
My number four is The Limey. We don't need to talk about it anymore. We've talked about it for an hour and a half. But that's my number four. What's your four, David?
The Limey.
I went a little higher with The Limey, just a tad.
What's your four, Ken?
That means I get to be the one to introduce a conversation on Magic Mike.
Great movie.
One of the greats.
Magic Mike's a great movie.
I think I cite Magic Mike.
It's so much fun.
Along with Boogie Nights and Jerry Maguire, those are probably the three most cited movies by me when I'm pitching shit out. There is just something about Magic Mike, scene by scene, the structure, the way that I will never get over the way that Alex Pettifer is introduced as protagonist and it changes midway through. I fucking love that. I love the excitement. I love the guys. I love everything about it. I think it's a really incredible movie. And it's also like very slyly, a really big moment in kind of, taking the knees out of toxic masculinity in this country.
Sure.
A lot of men would not watch it when it came out and found it eventually and realized this isn't so scary. So I think that's kind of like a sneaky little legacy of the movie as well.
I fully agree. It also feels like an Oscar snub to me that McConaughey didn't get one.
Oh, a huge snub.
Yeah.
Like that to me feels like...
I forget why.
I forget why too. And forgive me, it's after or is it before Dallas Buyers Club?
It's before. And I think that Dallas Buyers Club is partly his win and his kind of like the McConaissance thing is partly them being like, we know we whiffed on not getting you in there for Magic Mike.
Yeah,
I can't remember. I mean, the thing about Magic Mike is I'm sure it was the reason it didn't get a hit. It was seen as like a somewhat trashy movie, right? It's about strippers. But like it was a huge box office hit. That is, it's a hit on the level of Ocean's 11 in terms of like it's a little bit of a like Soderbergh had been a little bit in the wilderness again for a few years, like making stuff like The Good German and Bubble.
And he's
taking on this genre, you know, he's making a male stripper movie, which no one certainly had ever made a successful box office hit out of that, you know, work environment. And even female stripper movies, even like Showgirls or Striptease, like were bombs. And I think were sort of like critically dismissed and sort of seen as like, oh God, that's too lurid. And like he threads that needle so perfectly. It is kind of him being like, yo, I can make a really crowd-pleasing hit out of a thing you might not think of.
And the other thing is Channing wasn't considered to be a star or a serious actor
He was not taken seriously, right? He was also seen, like, he's a pretty boy, he's a model, he's a dancer, right? You know, like, come on, like, to give me a break.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember being in
a movie.
That was a great theater going experience too. That was one of the better, like sitting in a theater with that movie. People fucking loved that movie. Like that movie worked like gangbusters. My number three is a movie that didn't work like gangbusters, Solaris. I love Solaris. I saw it, I think I saw it two or three times in the theater. It just really worked for me. But again, like, this is him in kind of limey mode in doing like a tone poem, memory play, you know, very sort of a very light script. Like, there's not a lot of dialogue in that movie. It's really just about, you know, something that Lem actually talks about on the commentary track, which is this fallacy he feels that movies can't show the thoughts of a character, that you have to like say them. And I think that this idea of telling, it's very Terrence Malick, right? It's the idea of like a visual poem and what that elicits and what you kind of bring to it and your baggage or your life that you, and Solaris to me feels like one of those films, similar to the Tarkovsky original of like, what are you bringing to this movie? And what you bring to it is what you're going to get out of it. And I think it's Clooney stretching muscles that he hasn't really done before up until this point, really kind of pushing himself. I know it was supposed to be Daniel Day-Lewis, and I certainly would have loved to have seen that movie.
Yeah, I love this.
But I, and it just, and Cliff Martinez's unbelievable score. It's beautifully shot. It's produced by James Cameron. I was kind of hoping you guys were going to do an episode in your Cameron miniseries on Solaris because he produced it. But it's just, it's, I think it's a fascinating movie. I don't know what your thoughts are, David.
I'm going to hold off because that's going to show up later.
Yes. All right,
but I'm interested. I love Solaris.
I it would be 5A or 5B. I mean, I only wrote down six movies, so I put Contagious. I put Contagion above it. Frankly, because I didn't want to lead the conversation on Solaris, but I love it. I remember sitting in the theater and just having it wash over me. It's an incredible movie.
Yeah. It's an incredible film. What's your number three, David?
My number three is Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which is something I wrestle with because in way, it's a dated movie in some ways. And like, I feel like Soderbergh might roll his eyes at me putting it high because to him, he might be like, well, come on. Like I've done so much since then. And that was such a like, you know, get on the map movie versus, but I still think it's a pretty undeniable thing. And I still think like, it, take away the videotape, it's still a pretty current movie about sexual politics. Yes. Surprisingly so, given that it's like more than 30 years old.
And
everyone in it's so good.
I consider putting it on too. On an early list before I went through the whole filmography, it was there for me. Just subject matter. Just I remember watching it in college and just being so shocked by what someone was willing to put on film. No pun. And so I really love that movie. It's kind of a cornerstone movie for me.
It's funny to think about I don't think of him as a shocking filmmaker in general. It's not like he then is like, yeah, I'm going to be the guy who puts it all out there in my movie. You know, like he's as good a studio filmmaker as he is an indie filmmaker.
That's part of why it's so good, because it wasn't presented in a way that it was trying to shock you. It was presented in a very matter-of-fact confessional way, like literally. But, you know, I mean, just everything Spader does in that movie is kind of, I don't know, it's almost like emotionally exhausting to think about it. How vulnerable he is. But I'm crazy about it.
What's your three, David? Kenny?
That's my three.
The Limey. All right. My number two is Ocean's 11. I mean, it's there's not much more we can say about it, but I'll just say this. Whenever it's on and it feels like it's always on TBS or TNT or something like that, I get sucked into it. I have to watch it. It's undeniably rewatchable. It's similar to you, David. I hate airplanes, so it's an airplane movie for me, which is that it's very calming and it makes me feel good and it's all fine and good. So that's my number two. What's your two, David?
Out of Sight, which I would imagine is a lot of people's number one and would be close for me and is a perfect movie, top to bottom, and one of the great movies of the 90s, and one of the great movie star movies of all time, probably. And, like, it's the Clooney movie, right? Like, you know, Clooney doesn't have a movie career without this movie, if you think, you know. And it's the... I don't know, the template for like every noir movie and it's like that comes since. And it's, it's a career highlight from pretty basically every single actor who's in it. And I've watched it a million times. It's a perfectly edited movie. It has one of the best love scenes I think ever put in film, where they're, you know, intercutting between them having the conversation and taking their clothes off. Like, it's just one of those special things where it feels like everyone's getting together to be like, let's have a good time and make this really fun movie that's kind of like a bit of a throwback and a pulpy and romantic and silly and sexy and, you know, and they just, it just like every single ingredient was perfect, and thus the most sort of like perfect version of that movie was created.
Yeah, it's one of those films where, you know, it also revitalized a genre a little bit. Like, I think that it's an unsung hero in a lot of ways, in terms of, like, obviously Tarantino was the guy that sort of changed the way people perceived all those kind of schlocky films from the past. But this film found a way to do that in a more subtle way, if we're being honest. Like, it's not a movie that's rubbing your face in how cool it is. It's just effortlessly cool. Scott Frank's script is unbelievable. And it's, you know, Jennifer Lopez obviously had a moment last year with Hustlers, which is a tremendous movie, and she's great in it. But anyone who was surprised that she was capable of that performance has not seen Out of Sight, because she is fucking fantastic in Out of Sight.
Amazing.
Yeah. So
I'll do two and one because it's, you mm-hmm. know, here we are. Ocean's 11 is two, Out of Sight is one.
Same with me.
Yeah.
For everything David said. I mean, like, this is, yeah. it's, and I think you really hit the nail on the head for me, David. I don't get the feeling that anybody went into that movie thinking they were going to make one of the great movies of the 90s.
Right. There's not that ambition, like,
yeah,
that can sort of choke a movie out, right? Like, that kind of like, this is it. Like, you know, like, which even Ocean's 11 has that kind of swagger. Yeah. Like, Out of Sight's just like, hey, we're making a fun movie. Like, it's an Elmore Leonard book. Like, yeah, this will be fun. Yeah.
And I think that there were a lot of movies like this made throughout the 90s that weren't nearly as successful. Like, I mean, The Long Kiss Goodnight reminds me of this to some extent. Get Shorty reminds me of this, of course. I mean, there's even a dumb movie like Reindeer yeah. Games reminds mm-hmm. me of this. Like, there are a lot of movies that try to do something like this because it is, you know, such a sexy premise. But there, but this is just like, it's just a shooting yeah. star. I love every fucking in this movie.
I have a question for you. I have a real quick question for you guys, because both these films came out in 98. Which do you like better, Out of Sight or Jackie Brown?
Jackie Brown's 97, not 98. You crazy
is it?
Person.
Is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Christmas 97. This Christmas, Papa's got a brand new bag.
My apologies. The question still stands, because they're both Elmore Leonard, yeah, you know, adaptations. Well, and Nicolette and is the
Michael
connecting.
Keaton, yeah. Right, plays the same yeah. character in both of them. Those are two movies I adore, and they're very different.
Yeah, same. It's a tough choice. I might give Out of Sight the edge. A slight edge.
I think I pick Out of Sight because it is, like I say, perfect. Whereas Jackie yeah. Brown, I adore, but does, you know, it's like kind of yeah. big and loopy and has some side tangent stuff. And, like, you know, it's yeah. got that Tarantino flavor where he kind of lets things run long in a way where you let him get away with it. But Out of Sight is just kind of tough to argue with. I don't know.
I love comparing movies. It's one of my favorite things to do. And there's something about this comparison that I don't like. There's something about, like, by picking one, which I would pick Out of Sight, it's not even a question for me. It doesn't mean in any way yeah. that I don't think
no,
Jackie
I know.
Brown is, like,
yeah.
you know, an 8 plus 10 out of 10. Yeah. So, you know, Out of Sight is just on that, like, probably top 15, top 10 movies of all
sure.
time for me. So it really, it's a special, incredible movie.
So David, I've deduced what your number one is.
Yes, let's see. I want to hear the
oh, yeah, Solaris.
Let's hear it.
Yeah, that's my favorite Soderbergh movie. I mean, it's just a personal thing. Like, it's a movie I've watched a lot, which I suppose is odd because it is a frosty and very, very sad movie. And of course, it's also a remake of, like, a total genre defining masterpiece. And it was held up against the movie it's remaking from the second it existed. And it, you know, obviously it's, that's a very tough shadow to live in. But it's a movie that's very special for me. I mean, it's just like one of the most emotionally real films he has ever made. And that's funny to think of because it's a stylish movie and it's a space movie and all that. But like, it's also this sort of like very grounded little sort of play with these four great actors, Viola Davis, Jeremy Davis, Natasha McElhone with Clooney, all kind of like dealing with their insecurities in front of each other in ways that play out in all kinds, you know, like, and like, I love the Tarkovsky movie as well, but like Solaris is basically like 100 minutes of like, what if you could not get over something? And then you went to a place that made you have to get over it or have to at least confront it. And I saw it in theaters. I thought it was brilliant. I've seen it a million times since. When I interviewed Steven Soderbergh, I had to tell him like, hey, like, I love Solaris. Like that's maybe my favorite movie of yours. And he immediately was just like, yeah, but I built all the sets, you know, so it cost too much money. Why did I do that? Like that was his reaction to me saying like, I love Solaris. He's like, yeah, but it costs like $60 million because I built all the sets. And like, it could have cost less. Like I was so into myself. Like what was I doing building all the sets? And I was like, well, I love it. And he just kind of gave me this like, you know, this sort of shrug of like, okay. So, which is funny because then I interviewed Barry Jenkins with for sort of like a pandemic-y, like, what movies are you watching when you're in lockdown?
Yeah.
And he brought up Solaris. He said he'd shown it to his partner, which I also have done. And my partner's reaction was like, that movie was incredibly depressing. Why did you make me watch it? And he described it as the longest 100-minute movie ever made.
Well, it is.
You know, because it's not a long movie, but it does feel like.
Yeah.
You know, I'm happy I didn't leave the conversation because I think I would have called it a 2.5-hour movie.
No, it's like 90 minutes.
Right. It's yeah, not, it's not even 100 minutes long.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And
his
he said, you know,
his partner's Lulu Wang, right?
That's right. Yes.
I'm guessing.
And
she
had never
it.
Seen it. And I think so. Yeah. And he said he knows Soderbergh, right? He's not good friends with him, but he knows him and he's talked to him over the years. And that anytime he brings up Solaris, Soderbergh like kind of doesn't talk about it. He's just like, sort of like, eh, I don't want to talk about it. So like clear, I do think that like, it is, he does regret that movie didn't connect at all. Obviously it was like weirdly marketed. It's sort of a famous F Cinema Score movie. And it's such a funny little blot in his career and in Clooney's career. Cause that's when Clooney was really like a total hit maker. Like, you know, he really was in a lot of smashes just year after year, like post Batman and Robin, post him being like, I'm not going to make, you know, shitty Hollywood stuff. I'm only going to make stuff that I think is good and work with directors. I love it. I watch it all the time. I watched it recently. It's great. It's my favorite.
Solaris is one of those funny movies where it's not a movie for a mass audience, obviously. But where Soderbergh was and where Clooney was and where the culture was in terms of the way we worship stars and the way we were kind of entertainment night and Access Hollywoodified, it was presented as a big space epic. And there was an expectation that this was going to be, if not a fun movie, a compelling movie, which it is. I'm not saying it's not, but I mean for a mass audience. I think the whole thing was the whole thing was, you know, you go to space and your dead wife is there, right?
Yeah,
right.
And that's a hook. I see that hook for, you know, but it's not the movie I think that any audience expected. The F Cinema Score makes perfect sense. That's how that happens so often. You know, that's how Mother gets an F Cinema Score.
Where you put I would also say too,
right?
The movie that it most reminds me of is Eyes Wide Shut. Now, Eyes Wide Shut, I think, is obviously a very different film, but similarly has sexual overtones that are deeply upsetting and cold. It's about regret. It's about a male character dealing with his relationship with his wife. Like all, it's all kind of there. And I think there's something interesting to those two movies, both kind of not really connecting with audiences and both having gigantic movie stars. Like it just goes to show there's a ceiling to where audiences will go for Tom Cruise and George Clooney. And we found it.
100%.
In those movies. Yeah. When Solaris was what? 2004?
Two.
So we're two years away. I think it's going to have an interesting reappraisal in 2 years.
Yeah.
in the 20th. I do think it's better regarded now. Like, at the time, I think people were really like, why would you remake this movie? Mm-hmm. And why is this the result? Like, and for the one thing, of course, that's changed since it came out is that Viola Davis became one of the sort of like totemic actors. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Solaris, she's still very much like, oh, she's an out of sight too. Like, she's a character mm-hmm. actor. Yep. She's a good character actor. I think at the time, like, some people might have recognized her, but like, mm-hmm. she's fantastic in that movie. And now, like, so and Jeremy Davis has had sort of a great character mm-hmm. actor career. So you have that as well on rewatch of like, oh, this is like kind of a nice little ensemble.
Yeah.
David, I want to ask you a question that you may know the actual answer to. And if not, you know, please speculate. We're an hour, 50 minutes into the podcast. No one's listening. What do you think Steven Soderbergh considers his best film?
It's a great question. I bet you it's Out of Sight. I wonder, though. I wonder what his answer to that would be. Maybe it's Traffic. I mean, like, it's funny how Traffic is kind of ignored now. Like, yeah. It's sort of a dated movie.
Yeah.
It's got his color filter thing, which at the time was sort of fun and now has become such a trope that I think people are really sick of it. Like, oh, you know, you're lighting Washington in cold blue lights and you're lighting Mexico in this sort of like dusty orange. Like, whereas at the time, I think he was just like, it's just a good way to differentiate between all the timelines.
Yeah.
I would hazard a guess that it's Out of Sight because everything just worked with that. But I wonder if he has like a personal favorite that he would go to the mat for.
It's interesting.
Like Che.
Che is not bad. I like Che. It's a long one. It's a tough hang. Like, if you do them both, which you kind of should, because like they're very it's very much a two part movie. Like, it's not like they're separate films.
It's not like It where you.
But there's a lot of great stuff in Che.
Phil said to me on text before that there is a movie that he expected you to have and that he had. That's obviously Solaris now. What I thought it would be, and there are just two more movies I want to just kind of touch on real fast. I thought it would be The Informant. For whatever reason,
really,
because I love Solaris and I hate
it's a good movie.
It's a good movie.
But I thought it would be The Informant, and I thought, and then also, obviously, it doesn't quite. It didn't make any of our lists, and I understand why. But Beyond the Candelabra, I think, does deserve a little mention as a later term Soderbergh movie that really kicked ass.
It's phenomenal, I'm thrilled that it didn't end up being the last movie that he ever made, but you know, it was an interesting bow out, you know, at the time. It certainly felt like, you know, the end of something. Yeah, it's a great movie. Michael Douglas is tremendous in that film. I mean, he's really, really,
so
really
is Damon. Good in that
movie. Yeah.
Damon's fantastic. Supporting Damon is always good. Like, he's one of the most underrated supporting actors, and obviously, Soderbergh's used him supporting a lot because he's sort of supporting in all the Oceans movie. Like, the joke in the Oceans movies, right, is sort of like Clooney and Pit of the Stars, and Damon's like, I'm a movie star too. And they're like, oh, okay.
It might be the best part of that movie.
And the way he pops up in Che, in Contagion, right, you know, like he in behind, you know, he's always, and I like The Informant. The Informant is more like, maybe outside the top 10 for me. Like, I've only seen it once or twice.
Same.
I liked it. Some people really, truly love that movie, like, deeply. But I didn't know if that was you, Phil. And then one other thing I wanted to ask, if you don't, we can keep talking Informant. I'm down.
No. What do you want to ask?
How do you feel about his last three films? Unsane, High Flying Bird, and The Laundromat, which are obviously very different films, very differently received, differently exhibited. Like, I don't know. I'm just kind of an open-ended question on that.
I really loved High Flying Bird, which I think is a pretty smart movie. I've seen it again. I enjoyed it both times. I saw it in a theater because they screened movies for critics, even if they're Netflix, which is funny because no one saw that movie in a theater. But I saw it on Netflix later. I think that's a brilliant movie. I think like that is his sort of formal experimentation working best because it's matching with a movie that's about, like, why don't we experiment with the form that is the business of the NBA? The Laundromat, I did not like at all. I remember, like, kind of being dialed into the first 20 minutes, and then it just totally lost me when it's sort of, like, dipping into the various sort of plots of, like, here are various people who are affected by this. And some of the plots kind of worked for me, and others I was zoning out. And it did
not. The Meryl
not
reveal at the end is absolutely.
The Meryl reveal is baffling, and, like, like, I would need to watch it a bunch more to even try and sort of figure out what he's trying to get at with that. And I didn't like the movie enough. But Unsane is a movie that when I saw it, I think I was still in that mode where I was like, well, it's just great that he's making movies again. So this is cool. And I remember thinking it was a pretty good ride, but I don't remember it that well. It also uses the cell phone thing kind of well, right? Because it feels like a movie that's been smuggled out. But like, it wasn't a movie that like stuck with me where I'm like, this is like a top 10, top 20 movie of the year for me.
Right. I know that's a movie Phil and I both felt like we couldn't hazard.
too triggering for me. I'm not watching a movie that questions my sanity right now. I think that's a bad idea. So let's rate this movie real quick and then throw it next week. But in 99, I probably would have given the film a 75. I liked it. I didn't love it. It absolutely fucking slayed me this time around. Before the podcast, I'd give it a 90, and probably after, I'd give it a 91 or a 92. I think it's a near perfect film. I absolutely adored it. What did you think, Kenny?
I'd say in 2000, 2001, when I first saw it, it's an AVP. We watched it. I watched it a ton of times. I loved it. Hadn't seen it in about 15 years at least. I gave it an 86 after this. I do think, we didn't discuss it, I do think it slows down a little bit in the middle. And it does kind of lose the momentum. But when Nicky Catt comes in, it gets it back in a major way. It kind of supercharges the movie. That said, I mean, we're talking about, you know, very, very small level of disagreement. I am going up. I do think it's incredible. I'm going to give it a 91.
Yeah, it's a 90 for me. It's like a 4.5 out of 5 for me, for sure. And top 10 of 99 for me, I believe. Yeah, let me check my list. I have it 7th in my 1999.
Oh, you do? can you give us a list again? I know you did with Mystery Man, but
can you read us your list, David?
It may have changed. It changes all the time. My list always changed. Number 1, Eyes Wide Shut. 2, The Matrix. 3, The Iron Giant. 4, Straight Story. 5, The Insider. 6, Blair Witch. 7, Limey. 8, Being John Malkovich. 9, Mr. Ripley. 10, Rosetta. Those are my 10. Yeah. But honestly,
it was unusual.
That's a great list. It's a great
list. There's 30 great movies that year, you know?
Or is
Beau Travail? I have that as a 2000 movie because of it was released in America in 2000. That's a difficult one for me because I know it's 99 by calendar. Like, but I have that on my 2000 list.
Well,
I go by America.
Do it because we take anything that could possibly be considered 99 and eat it up. We're doing Audition later today.
Nice.
So next week we have your friend Joe Reed coming on, David, to do the Messenger. What are your thoughts on Luc Besson?
Talk about another director who made one of his less lauded movies.
I think I have seen the Messenger. I think I saw it on TV when I was a teenager. I have no memory of it. I remember having like as typical for Luc Besson, these very like showy battle sequences that are striking.
Right.
But I also it kind of being like insanely meandering and super long, like
2 hours and 45 minutes.
Oh, exciting to watch!
Right. and what he's a fucking troublesome guy.
What are your feelings on? I mean, taking the personal out of the equation, because we all know that he's obviously a problematic dude. What are your thoughts on his films, like on The Professional, The Femme Nikita, or, you know, are you a fan or not?
I like him as a stylist. I have always thought his films were mostly flash in the pan, except for the sci-fi movie. I really do love The Fifth Element and Valerian because they have that kind of very sincere, goofy outlook. Whereas like The Professional is kind of like a nasty movie. Again, it's very cool. It's very stylish. Jean Reno is very good in it. But and same with La Femme Nikita. Like those movies are kind of like, they're a little gross. Whereas like The Fifth Element is so sweet. Like it's such a children's movie in a way.
It is.
And the same for Valerian. Lucy is also a movie that kind of like,
it's batshit.
Like kind of quietly. It's just funny because he's made like terrible movies. Like he strikes me as someone who's really slapdash. He had that like weird period post Fifth Element where The Messenger kind of ruins him, and he mostly produces. And when he directs, it's like, you know, animated films or like shit, like The Family and The Lady, which like those are awful movies. So it's like there's no consistency with the guy.
Even though I forgot about movies. The Family. And, like,
The Family isn't The Family the with Diana Arbor?
Michelle Pfeiffer?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a
The Family is Michelle Pfeiffer and De Niro, yeah.
Yeah.
The cinema du look guys, right? This sort of 80s poppy French directors. Like you have Leo Carax, who doesn't make a movie unless he really wants to make it. And his movies are unlike anything else. And you have Jean-Jacques Beignet, who like Diva and Betty Blue, like those are crazy movies. Like, like I don't know. Like, you know, Besson feels a little more like he was like, I can be sort of a Spielberg. But it means he takes a lot of shots he misses, and apparently he's.
I think that he's a guy who just didn't have a third act to his career. You know what I mean? Like his early French films are really interesting. He has some, you know, a couple big studio hits, and then it really just sort of goes kind of nowhere. But Lucy's,
I think the Fifth Element is as good as it gets.
It's great.
Truly, like Fifth Element's almost like Moulin Rouge for me in that it's everything, right? Like it is the most cinema, which is my favorite genre. He doesn't really do it again. I mean, maybe I never saw Valerian. Is Valerian really that good?
Valerian's insane. Did you? Were you?
Was that?
It's a great movie. I know you guys will never do Besson on your podcast because, you know, let's not shine a light on a guy who's obviously problematic. But it would be a very interesting miniseries for you guys to do.
I think at this point he's pretty much off the table for us. He's always been tough for us because there's this chunk of shit in the middle that you would like. Do you compress? Do you like try and do them really fast or something if you're approaching him as a filmography? But now it's also just like, I don't know. Like,
I agree. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on. We really, really appreciate it. This was a blast.
Yeah, it's the best.
Of course. Thanks for having me, guys. It's fun. It's always fun.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.